Six.
Five.
Four.
My name is Scott Lee, and I'm an alcoholic. And absolutely can't tell you how thrilled I am to be here. Thank you again to Andy and Lynn and Linda and Patrick for giving us this opportunity, and for you for coming, and we are so grateful to be here.
And George.
And George, forgive me. Yes. And for the significant others who gave them kitchen passes so they could get out and go to the meetings and all. Maybe they don't have kitchen passes here. I want to talk a little bit about step five. Generally speaking, step five is a confession. Page 73 at the bottom, psychologists are inclined to agree with us. We've spent thousands of dollars for examinations. We know but few instances where we've given these doctors a fair break. We have seldom told them the whole truth, nor have we followed their advice. And I have a friend who says he believes that alcoholics should not go to medical doctors and psychologists, psychiatrists. We should go to veterinarians. But it's because veterinarians are used to trying to guess what's wrong with their patients. I've got a friend that says he used to pay a psychiatrist $100 an hour to lie to him. And that's just how typical is that? On page 74, it talks quite a bit. You have to realize, let's go in context now. This book was written, there were fewer than 100 people sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. So there weren't qualified sponsors on every corner. There weren't people who had done this work on every corner. But the overriding principle is that I must be, if you look at the last paragraph, begins with notwithstanding. At bottom of 74, count up three lines. It says, the rule is we must be hard on ourselves but always considerate of others. It means my wife can't hear my fifth step. It means I can't tell anybody anything that would harm them or have a negative effect on them in any way. And it suggests several ways to find someone to hear a fifth step. And again, this is simply what I do. The men that I sponsor are welcome to do their fifth step with anyone they like and me. and there are a couple of reasons. One of them is I'm going to hear things in their fifth step that belong in their eighth step that they were going to miss. That's a high percentage of the time. Another one is that I believe someone who's already done this is infinitely better qualified. And if you're in a religion that requires it, I think that's wonderful, but I want to hear it also. As I pray before hearing a fifth step, I ask God to make me perfect. Bob prays to be useful. I ask God to make me perfect. And I mean that, and I do it. Page 13. Two-thirds of the way down, I was to test my thinking by the new God. Consciousness within common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I pray for myself, except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. I want you to know that I believe that as I sit to hear someone's fifth step and I ask God to make me perfect, I believe that he does. I believe that when I ask God for what he wants me to have, I get a lot of help. It's about me getting to the right question. I wrapped a man in a blanket and held him while he cried for about 45 minutes when he talked about his father. Of my own wisdom, I don't know to do those kinds of things, but I believe God blesses it. I also have a horror story. My sponsor sponsored a guy who chose to do his fifth step with a preacher. And he did his fifth step on a Saturday. On Sunday morning, his preacher used his fifth step as the sermon in the church with him sitting with his wife in the front row. I'll be astounded if they recover from that. So it needs to be a closed mouth friend. Top of page 75 gives me a one-sentence direction on how to do a fifth step. It says we pocket our pride and go to it illuminating. That means to shine light into. Top of 75, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. It's a confession. This is what I've learned. I ask him, and I don't let him schedule a fifth step till he's through with four. I'm not going to let him bash himself into completing his four step because he's got a schedule to do five. I want him to continue to work the schedule that we've laid out. When he gets through with it, that'll be fine. We schedule a time. We have a room in our home. Miss Linda and I had a ceremony. Now, we are married. But we also had a ceremony in our home in an upstairs room we call the meditation room, where we offered God everything we had specifically. We offered him the home. We offered him the grounds. We offered him, and it's not like it's that big, the grounds, you know. We offered him the cars. We offered him just everything we could think of very specifically, including our relationship. And in that room, there are a lot of fifth steps. And people we sponsor use that room for fifth steps. They just call us and let us know. We turn off the phones. We get out the Kleenex. We've got a refrigerator up there. We are self-contained. And I ask him to pray for, and I say, how do you feel? And I want him to be nervous. The guy sitting down to do his first fifth step that isn't nervous is wasting my time, because he knows what he's not going to tell me. He's already decided what he ain't going to tell me. And a guy I sponsor called one on that here not too long ago. He says, we're wasting our time. You already know what you're going to tell me. He said the guy came apart in tears and told him. And so I want him nervous, because he's either going to tell me or he's not sure. I'll settle for either one of those. And I ask him to pray for an open heart and to invite God here, because we said, so let's invite God. And then when we come out of the prayer, what I do is I ask him, I say, I want you to tell me the single worst thing you ever did. I want it right now. It is amazing to me how slowly we'll go through the small stuff about cheating on the exam in the third grade on the way to the big stuff. If we get the big stuff first, this doesn't take too long. I've seen fifth steps run to the second day. Not anymore. Not for me. I want to hear the worst thing you did. And in my lineage, we do not hear fifth steps. We exchange them. As you talk about what you did, if I've done it, and I probably have, then I'll tell you when I did it or something similar. And now I want to hear the second worst thing you ever did. And I'm going to talk about when I did it. Now I want to hear the third. I'm going to do that until he runs out. And then we can take a look at your four-step. If you're going to read me your four-step, read it into a tape player and I'll listen to it on the plane. I don't think that's going to do us much good. So I want to hear the confession and I want you to hear mine. Because part of what happens here is that he now has, because I've maybe done some things he hasn't done. When he starts sponsoring someone who's done them, he knows where to come. And it's funny, I don't remember people's fifth steps. Except when you have a problem and it lights up and say, I know someone. Let me put you in touch with someone I think can help you with that. And it's amazing how quickly those things come back. And then I have him review his fourth step and look around for other places where he's done harm. When we both think we're finished, I ask a series of questions. Have you harmed a human or an animal? Amazing how many of us have beaten dogs. I'm astounded at how many of us have done that. Have you had sex with an animal or a family member? Have you had, if it's a heterosexual male, have you had a homosexual experience? Have you been involved in an abortion? And I don't know how that is over here. It's a very hot issue in the States politically. Don't hear that. It's legal over there, but there are people that are torn up about it anyway. So have you been involved in one of those? And or is there anything that you had decided not to tell me or you weren't sure that you haven't already told me? And then I read him the fifth step promises here in the middle of page 75. And I'm not going to do that now. You can read them. And then I send him home to do the second half of the fifth step. It says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. Now, maybe he hadn't got a place, in which case I'll leave him there where he is. It says, carefully reviewing what we've done. So that tells us what we're going to do for this hour. We're going to review what we've done so far. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better. Oh, I also tell him that I forgive him, that I believe God forgives him, and that by the time we get through with the ninth step, he will have forgiven himself. I see that very consistently. Taking this book down from our shelf. Okay, I'll expect you to go home and put your big book up on a shelf, and it'll need to be shoulder high or higher so you can take it down from the shelf. And I want to know tomorrow that you did that. I'm serious about it. Now, I think it's stupid, too, but I mean it. Turn to the page that contains the 12 steps, carefully reading the first five proposals. We ask, this is a prayer, we ask if we have omitted anything, for we're building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. As our work solid so far, are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? Metaphorically, we're saying, have I left anything out? I also like to tell them that somewhere around half of the time I get a phone call within the next 24 hours that you have forgotten something. Won't mean you've done a poor job. It's not at all uncommon. It runs somewhere around half, would you say? Mm-hmm. Something like half of the people think of something else or a couple of things in the next 24 hours. And so just give me a phone call when you can talk. Won't be a problem. And then it says, interestingly enough, at the top of page 76, if we can answer to our satisfaction, that's that we've been thorough on the first five, metaphorically. We then look at step six. Oh, I don't get 2 weeks off? No. Same day. Oh, and by the way, on the trip home after we finish and I send you home, I don't want the radio on in your car. I don't want you on your cell phone. I don't even want you listening to one of my CDs. All right? That's commitment by me, by the way. And because I want you to hold focus. And then at the top of 76, we've emphasized willingness being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? It's a simple question. Are you? Can he take them all, every one? And then here's a prayer if you need it. If we still cling to something, we will not let go. We ask God to help us be willing. So there is a prayer in the sixth step if you need it, if you're not willing. And it says you pray that prayer. And then it says, when ready, we say something like this: my Creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness. We're back to that usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. It does not say, I'm not asking him to remove all my character defects. Only the ones that stand in the way of my usefulness to him and to my fellows. Isn't that interesting? In the short form of the step, it looks like I'm asking him to take them all, but in this prayer, I'm clearly not. I had the experience not too long ago of God using one of my remaining character defects as a tool to help me. But what Bob and I do up here is pretty dangerous. And I don't know if you understand what I'm talking about. But it feeds something in me that needs to be starved. And we don't present ourselves as experts, but people perceive us that way. And you tell us how great we are and all that. That doesn't help this part of me, and yet I have a mission here. And I let myself get up on a pedestal. It's okay if you put me on a pedestal as long as I don't climb up there myself. And I climbed up there myself, and I found myself involved in something that was going to make me very, very sick, and realized it and stepped down off my pedestal. And God used that mistake of mine as a tool to help me. Interesting. Powerful God. My sponsor told me that steps 6 and 7 say nothing about me removing my own defects of character. When I'm working on my defects, I'm living in the problem. Classic example, living in the problem. I've got three things that I call my spiritual barometers. They are lying, well, not actually lies, improvements, really, upon the truth. Lying, swearing, and my attitude toward those of you who possibly got your driver's licenses out of Cheerios boxes. And if one of those gets out, if I look, they're all out. And I can't change me. I hear people, I got to change me. If I could change me, I would have changed me. We'd have probably never met. I can't change me. I can change my actions this day, and therein lies a tremendous power. But I don't change me. And so when I find myself lying, swearing, or angry with you in traffic, I don't work on those character defects. I inventory my actions over the last few days. I'm told my priority is not what I say it is. My priority is what I do. Want to know what my priorities are? Don't listen to my words about the future. Look at my actions in the last few days. What was accomplished was a priority. What was not accomplished was not a priority. And anything that I say to the contrary is a lie that I'm telling me. And I hated that when I first heard it, because I was saying some things were priorities and I wasn't doing anything about them. Priority is not what I say, it's what I do. And when I get angry with you in traffic and I start losing control of my language, if I look back over the last few days, there are holes in my spiritual program. I told you this morning my meditation was short, my prayer was short, I didn't read my two pages. I'm thin right now, and I know, and I'm tired also. So I'm thin and know it. When those things start happening, I look back over the last few days, and I haven't taken a meeting into the jail in 2 weeks, and I haven't called my sponsor, and I haven't done the things I'm told. And I go back, my hardest ones are my morning prayer and meditation have gotten short. And I go back and do those things you've taught me to do. And 2 days later, you can cut me off in traffic and almost hit me. And I will smile at you from in here. I will smile and I'll wave at you, and I wave my whole hand. They do that here too. Yeah. I wave the entire thing And I'll say, God, go with that one today. And thank you so much that I saw he was going to cut me off. And I was able to hit the brakes and not be in a wreck with him. It would have been his fault. I'm grateful not to be in a wreck. And God bless him. I bet he needs some help today. He's not having a very good day. Go with him. I make those mistakes myself. And I can't change me from the raving lunatic 3 days ago that would have tried to run him off the road and beat him up. I can't change me because I don't work on my character defects. My sponsor said my character defects are all self-centered by definition. And self does not have the power to push self out of the center. And if it did, it would leave a vacuum. And so the answer to my character defects is not for me to work on them. It's for me to go back and do the things that you have taught me to do to lead a God-centered life. And when I do that, my character defects just recede. I don't take power over them. I don't focus on the darkness. What I do is I invite the light back in. And the light comes and the darkness flees because it cannot exist in the light. Bob.
Thanks, Scott. And Bob's still an alcoholic.
Hey, Bob.
There's a lot to be said for taking a fifth step, and I think there's even more to be said for hearing one. I've heard probably 200 over the years. And it is in the hearing of the fifth step that I have found myself more than in the telling of the fifth step. And there's something that happens to us as we, it's not, it refers to this in the 12 by 12, that it refers to not only has told their whole life story, but heard someone else tell theirs, that something happens to us. And I think if nothing else, we start to awaken to something. And I don't know how many fifth steps you have to hear before you start to see something that you can't deny. And what that is that it's something that Einstein once referred to. He said one time that the great illusion of mankind was that there's more than one of us here. You listen to enough fifth steps and you start to realize it's the same person. It's the same person over and over. I haven't heard anything new in a fifth step in probably 27 years. I just heard one not too long ago. I was hoping for something new. I was hoping for something interesting, something exciting. You know, Visqueen, a vibrating lawn rake, chunky peanut butter, a mule, something interesting. But it's never anything like that. It's always the same pathetic, vacant, scared, inadequate person driven by their fears and self-centeredness to try to fix themselves frantically and make themselves better. And in the process, they step on the toes of everybody around them in the process of trying to make themselves better. They ruin their whole life. They burn it to the ground and they don't even know why. It's the same story over and over and over and over again. And isn't it odd that some of us come here absolutely convinced that we are unique, that our case is different, and that we're so lonely, and somewhere as a result of taking these steps and then helping to other people to take them, we start to develop a sense of community. We start to realize the truth is that you are me. In step seven, I'm saying something to God that is very interesting, something that wouldn't have occurred to me. I'm not asking him to take away the things that stand in the way of my happiness or that stand in the way of my becoming rich and famous or being wonderful or the things that stand in the way of everybody realizing what a tremendous guy Bob is. I'm asking him only to take away the things that stand in the way of my usefulness, that I am claiming in step seven a commitment to a primary purpose, and that is to abandon myself and stop trying to fix me, and I am about my Father's business, which is helping his kids. And that is it. And most of the problems that I incur with guys that I sponsor and with myself and people that are in long-term sobriety seem to come back to step seven. It seems to be aspects of self, little judgments and resentments and fears that have come up once again and that have diminished my ability to be useful. Because what happens is I get back into me again. And my primary purpose slips incrementally, slowly away from being here to help other alcoholics back into helping me. And as we talked about in the delusion, is that no matter how much time and energy you put into trying to fix yourself, we only seem to get worse. And it is only from abandoning myself and going about my Father's business that I seem to get a sense at times of wholeness and completeness, of usefulness. So I'm about this business of becoming useful. And it's always stuff cropping up. It's always stuff. And a couple things that I've discovered about steps 6 and 7 for me is that I think all my character defects have two parts. And Bill refers to that in his story when he goes through in his personal story in the beginning of the book, he goes through a thumbnail sketch of the 12 steps. And he gets to step 6 and 7. And he refers to these things as asking God to remove them, root and branch, as if there's two parts. And we all know what the root, the branch is. That's the part that's been poking in the eye. That's the consequences. See, I want God to take away the consequences. But do I really want him to remove the defect? Because what are my defects? Aren't they just defense mechanisms that I've been relying on for decades to give me a false sense of security and protection and validation? Don't I use my anger because I'm under the illusion that it will protect me when I'm threatened? Did it ever protect me, or did it just push people out of my life and make me feel more alone? Didn't I use my lust because of a fear of being alone and a terror of having a life that will be boring and vacant and uneventful and unexciting? And yet, didn't my lust ultimately push me into a life that was boring and, you know, vacant and lonely? And as I awaken to the truth that these are defective defense mechanisms, there is never a defect of character that you will bring to the table in steps 6 and 7 that works. If they worked, they would never be on the table. We bring them to the table because it's only an illusion of value. There's no value. It's very similar to drinking. Most alcoholics cannot come to AA and come to God and buy the whole package here with their alcoholism until they really get it, that they've wrung all the fun out of the drinking. I mean, nobody gets sober in the fun days. I mean, why would you? And if you have, oh, that's terrible. I think that would be the biggest travesty of all. Imagine getting sober and then finding out you had 3 fun years left. Oh my God. No, we come here after we've rung 3 years past. We rung all the fun out of it. We've been kicking a dead horse for 3 years. And I think the same is true with most of my defects of character. Once I see the truth, then I realize there's no value, and it's not as difficult to take these things to God, to trust God. And that brings us up to step 8 and 9. Just very, very briefly, historically, in a sense, Alcoholics Anonymous was founded on one man's 8th step. If you know the history of how Alcoholics Anonymous was founded, Dr. Bob Smith was 12-stepped on Mother's Day weekend, 1935. And after he sat with Bill for hours talking about this, the spiritual principles that Bill had gleaned from the Oxford group and this new way of life and the things he's been putting together, which was the rudimentary foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Bob liked it all, except the amends. He liked the help in others. He liked the confession of shortcomings. He liked prayer and meditation. He liked God. He liked it all. But when it came to facing all the people he'd hurt in the community, he dug his heels in and he said to Bill, he said, I can't do that. He said, oh my God, you know, my drinking almost ruined my reputation as a doctor in this community as it is. And he dug his heels in. And consequently, Dr. Bob Smith drank again. And he came back from a convention, a medical convention in Atlantic City, so drunk on the train that the conductor didn't know what to do, so they just laid him on the platform at the Akron station. He was comatose, and they called his office manager, and she came down and got him, and then they eventually took him back to Ardmore Street to the Smith residence where Bill Wilson was living. And he came to early in the morning on what most historians believe was June 10th, 1935. And he came to shaking, as we will come to drinking cheap whiskey round the clock, day in and day out for several days. And he was jumping out of his skin, and his nerves were shot. And he said to Bill and to Ann Smith, he said, what day is it? And they said, it's the morning of June 10th. And Dr. Bob said, oh my God, it can't be June 10th. I have to perform a surgery the morning of June 10th. And he's like this. Imagine being his patient, watching your doctor come in like with a scalpel. Looks like he could thread a sewing machine, you know, just right. And Bill Wilson gave Dr. Bob some alcohol to drink and a sedative to stop the vibration and sent him into the surgery to perform this operation. And Dr. Bob was a proctologist, so you can use your imagination what kind of surgery this was. And nobody knows really what happened to that patient. It does say in the big book that he lived, but nobody really knows. I know one historian, Bill went into the Akron Hospital records trying to find out who the patient was and what had happened to him, because he'd like to know. I'd like to know. I mean, did the guy whistle when he walked or what? We don't know. I mean, we just know he lived. And that surgery was very quick. It was a small cancer surgery. And Dr. Bob got out of that, was done that surgery still in the morning of June 10th and disappeared. And Bill Wilson and Ann Smith were both afraid, as I would be, that he went on a drunk. I mean, they had to give him a drink to go before he went into the surgery. Easy assumption. But Dr. Bob did not go on a drunk. Dr. Bob, but yet he didn't come back all that morning, all that afternoon, and all that evening. And at almost midnight, he came back to Ardmore Street, and something was different about him. And he had spent that whole day searching out everyone he was afraid to face and make those amends. And consequently, Dr. Bob Smith never drank again the rest of his natural life. Low estimates is he personally helped and sponsored personally over 5,000 people. And I don't know how many millions that the people he helped. And I think most of us are sitting in this room as a direct result of one man's eighth step. What would have happened to us if Dr. Bob one more time would have dug his heels in and said to Bill, I'll do all of AA except that? There's nothing to lead me to believe that he would have stayed sober, because he didn't before. That was the major difference between May 11th and June 10th, is one man's eighth step, one man's willingness to make amends to them all. And I understand why Dr. Bob had to drink again and be beaten half to death by the bottle to become willing. Step 8 and 9, I think, is the most terrifying thing any of us ever do. It's frightening. I remember sitting in meetings as a newcomer, and in the years I was in and out, and I would hear people talk about amends, and I would just be so overwhelmed with fear. I would want to run. I would want to bolt out of AA. And I could hear you people talk about the amends you've made, and that's fine. Good for you. You don't understand about me. I have people that went to prison is a result of my actions. I have people, I have one guy to this day, I've hired detectives, I've never found him. He would never be the same because I took a knife with a blade about this long and I opened up his chest in a blackout. He was my best friend. I've never found him. I can't tell you that dozens of people, hundreds of people that I robbed. I lived on the streets like an animal. If I went down the street and a car was unlocked, I stole whatever was in there. If you were at the bar and you went to the bathroom, when you came back, I've drank your drink, I've taken your change, and if you had a purse there, it's gone. And I'm not talking about once or twice. I'm talking about a way of life. So I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're talking about making amends to them all, and I'm going, oh, no. Jeez. Oh, man. I would have never stolen all of that if I would have known this. I wouldn't have done all that. This is impossible. This is overwhelming. And I would just feel like my head was going to explode just contemplating this. It was too much. It's too big. But step 9 occurs after step 8, which occurs after step 6 and 7, which occurs after step 5, which occurs after step 4, which occurs after a decision in step 3, which occurs after 2 realizations of absolute powerlessness and absolute unmanageability and absolute helplessness. And I wasn't there yet.
Excuse me, the parking lot attendant is back.
All two, cars with 4 wheels.
Two 4x4s, a Mercedes 420, 9 GO, 7 XLT, and I don't know what this other one is. Shogun, SDO4DXE. Move them if you have further plans for them. Is that it? Sorry, Bob.
Okay. Or you can let them tow them and make amends later.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. But it terrified me. You know, there's a principle that the first time I think I've ever heard anyone talk about it was mentioned by the great psychiatrist Carl Jung, and it's the principle of synchronicity. Mm-hmm. And synchronicity is a principle that seems to permeate all of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what synchronicity is, it's a view of the universe that looks at the universe as if it is an exceptionally, miraculously accommodating place. In a synchronistic universe, if you are here at point A and you need to get over here to point B and you can't because there's an abyss between A and B that you will never surmount, from the moment of desire, and the word desire comes from 2 Latin words, of the Father. From the moment of desire and yearning for the change, the universe starts shifting subtly to eventually accommodate the impossible. And you don't have to sit in very many meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous till you hear the stories of God's grace, the stories of a synchronistic universe, the stories of people that could never get their family back, and they did. And then they'll tell you all the weird coincidences that had to happen for that to come down. And that's what we're facing here. And so in these amends that seem unreachable and impossible, in Alcoholics Anonymous, the impossible just takes a little longer. And the biggest battle I ever have to fight is to do my part. From the moment I take step 3, my life divides into my business and God's business. And in step 8 and 9, there's my business and there's God's business. My business in step 8, it says we made a list, my business to make the list of all persons we'd harmed, and became willing to make amends. That's God's business, is to provide the willingness. You know how I know it's his business and not mine? Because on page 76, there's a prayer where I ask him for that. And it's the last 2 lines in the middle paragraph, it says, if we haven't the will to do this, in other words, you have an amends and you just can't imagine facing those people. They're going to take a stick to you or hit you with a brick. You're not going to face them. You're not going to do this. You're not ready. Perfectly okay. It says, if we haven't the will to do this, we ask God. It's a prayer. And I ask until it comes. So I don't just say, God, give me the willingness to never think about it again. I ask until it comes. And so that's God's business. My business is to make the list. And in this paragraph, it says we already made it. We made it when we took step 4. So if you just finished your fifth step, and you have kind of a new age sponsor that wants you to burn it and watch the smoke go up to heaven or something like that, that's fine. That's fine. Make a copy first. Because you're going to need the names off of there for your 8-step list. Isn't it? Now talk about a 180-degree turn in consciousness. I don't know an alcoholic that has ever started making his resentment list that isn't unconsciously making a list of people that you know really owe you an amends. And then what happens? You come out the backside and you go, oh my God, another thing I'm wrong about. I owe them an amends. I was the fly in the ointment. I was the monkey wrench in this engine. I was the problem. Made decisions based on self. And so it is my business to have created the list in step 4. And it's my business to ask God for the willingness. And it's God's business to provide the willingness. And in step 9, it says, make direct amends wherever possible. It's God's business to create wherever possible. I don't have to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous I can't do. And so what I've discovered is that all my amends will fit into one of 4 categories. And some guys do these on index cards, and that's very good. Other guys will make 4 columns. That's fine. But I have understood that there's amends that I am willing, and I got the wherever. I know exactly where those people are. I know how to find them. That would be number 1. Those are the only amends I actually have to make today. They're the only ones. Number 2, it's the people where I know where they are, but I'm not really willing. You know how I know I'm not really willing? Because I haven't gone there yet. When you're really willing, you're pulling up in front of their house. I mean, you know, because willingness without action is fantasy. So the number 2 position is the people that I know where they are, but the truth is I'm not really willing. So I ask, all I have to do with number 2 is I have to pray. Number 3 are people that I really am willing. I know in my heart that I'd be willing, but I don't know where they are. That guy that I stabbed, I'll tell you, I've looked for him and looked for him. If I found out next week where he is, I would be on a plane as soon as possible to go see him. And I am willing, but I don't have the wherever. So God must make that possible. And I don't know when that's going to be. I just had some amends. I just got to make amends a couple weeks in July to a guy I hadn't seen for 35 years. And he pops up. And you know why I got to make amends at 30 now than I looked for him years ago? Is because he got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and he has 2 years and 8 months. And I got to meet him at a conference in Philadelphia, and I got to make my amends. And I got a gift from all that. I don't know if it's a good gift or a bad gift. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I don't know. But he told me some stories about myself that I was just starting to think I wasn't that bad. He told, and I got, my amends list got longer. He told me about a hideous thing I did that was involved. I wiped out a whole block of parked cars one time. I don't even remember this. I don't even remember. So I was willing, and God at 28 and a half years provides the wherever. I don't know why he provides. I know that when I was 17 years sober, I found a woman that I'd searched for when I was 3 and 4 and 5 years sober and could not find. And as a result of my finding her at 17 years sober, a friend of hers who knew me ended up going to his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I understood all of a sudden, every once in a while you can see the reason for the dance steps put out by the big choreographer. And sometimes you never see the reason for the dance steps. You just after a while realize it's a good dance. And I could see in that particular incident why. Why I could make that amends at 17 years so that this other guy, Jim, could get some help. See, isn't it funny that I always think it's about me? Sometimes it's not about me. There was a gal, Dave, I think, knows this gal. There was a gal in my old home group named Chelsea. And Chelsea, matter of fact, not only did she said I could tell this story, it makes her smile when she finds out. Next time I see her, I told that story about you again. She just, it lights her up. When Chelsea, before Chelsea got sober, she was a white gal that came from a kind of a redneck, very prejudiced family. And she fell in love with a black guy. And they got married, had a couple little babies, a mulatto babies that were just the cutest thing you've ever seen. And her dad, who was a bigot, went crazy when she married this black guy. And he was very vile, and he cussed her out and wouldn't have anything to do with her or those kids. And he called the kids names, and it was horrible, horrible. The guy was a real jerk. And she gets sober, and she's got this resentment. And it's the kind of resentment that most people in AA would agree with her. Oh, yeah, your dad's a jerk. Or, you know, everybody would agree with her, except her sponsor. Her sponsor believed in the principles on page 67, where we disregard the other person involved entirely. Her sponsor wanted to look at what kind of a daughter she'd been, and she realized that she hadn't been a very great daughter. So her sponsor gave her direction. And the direction was she was supposed to send pictures of the kids and Father's Day gifts and birthday gifts to her dad and Christmas gifts and little notes and call him. And even if he hung up on her, she'd call him anyway and say, hi, Dad. And he'd cuss her out and hang up on her. And she kept doing it. And I was amazed because she did it not just for a few weeks. She did it week after week, month after month, year after year in the face of rejection and hostility. And she kept acting in a loving manner like a loving daughter towards a sick father. In spite of his venom, in spite of his hostility. And 4.5 years later, she came to the home group and she read a letter from her father. And in the letter, her father said about how ashamed of himself he was for all his behavior. And he talked in there about how he'd been raised. And when he talked about it, you kind of got a little bit of an insight about his prejudices. And he talked in there, he said, the thing that got me weeping and everybody else in the room, because we'd been through this with her, is he said in the letter, he said, I know that I don't deserve to have you or those children in my life. But if you would give me another chance, I would do anything I can for the rest of my life to make that right. And we're weeping in the meeting because we know how she did the right thing in the face of that adversity. And I remember driving home that night, and I'm overwhelmed by this. I'm thinking to myself, my God, these spiritual actions, not only did it free her, eventually it changed him. When it says in the book, there's a long period of reconstruction ahead, that a mumbling that we are sorry don't fill the bill. That is so true. You know, my amends to my parents was, you know, there's the direct amends. But then before, my actions had to be consistently spiritual in nature and right on the money for a long period of time before they started to believe that I possibly could have changed. I had to, Chuck Chamberlain used to talk about, he'd rub his hands together and he'd say, you rub away the wreckage of your past with good works. And sometimes it's a long period of reconstruction. And I remember Chelsea, and I was so proud of her. See, because I'm an instant gratification guy. I want to make the amends, and then I'm looking for the band and the parade. I'm just that guy. But to do that for all those years in the face of adversity, to delay and wait and finally wait for God's grace to work. God sometimes works very slowly.
Let me do a couple.
Okay.
I'll do a couple on this.
Turn back over to Scott.
Thanks, Bob. I love that story. I find five prayers in the writing on steps 8 and 9 in the text, and we're on a time constraint, and so if you find a sixth one, send me an email. I'm on a constant search for things, and I'm sure they rewrite this all the time. It's interesting, as I send someone out to make an amend, I remind him that we're not asking you to turn your will and life over to the care of someone who may roundly hate you. That you and I prayerfully are final authority in what that amend will be. The person you're going to isn't necessarily. Although if they suggest something that seems reasonable for you, go ahead and act on it. But if it doesn't seem reasonable to you, come talk to me. I sponsored a guy, Big Ken Sweeney, and Ken said before he got sober, he hated everybody and he wished there was more of them. And if somebody had come to him to make amends, he would have bashed him for the rest of their lives. So we're not. That's not what we're setting you up for. So let's don't get confused on it. And I walked out of a meeting one time, and a fellow whose sponsor I sponsor said, "I disagree with what you said in the meeting. What I had said was that my amends to my children would never be complete." And he said, "That's not right." He said, "Did you go to your children and tell them what you thought you had done wrong? Did you ask them what you could do to repair the damage? Did you do what they said? Did you ask for their forgiveness? Did they give it?" I said, "Well, yes to all of that." He said, "You're trying to be the best father you can be today is not ninth step work, it's 12th. It's the principles in all your affairs. And if you think it's ninth step work, you have not received their forgiveness or God's or your own, and you have work to do." And I buy that. And this is a little soapbox of my own. And if your sponsor disagrees, I agree with whatever your sponsor says. Your sponsor's right and I'm wrong. And I mean that. I really do. But my book doesn't use the term living amends. If I think I'm trying to be a good father is spiritually awakened people who have children endeavor to be good parents. I have watched teenage and older children manipulate us into some very sick things under the banner of "you were a lousy parent in the past." I've made my amends. Trying to be a good father today is 12-step work. I share that with you because I got free that day. And maybe somebody else needs to get free in something similar. I'm going to talk for a few moments about what for me was the worst thing I've ever. Those of you who were here last night heard me talk about reaching bottom, laying there in that bed in the treatment center, and my soul screaming for forgiveness and getting it. And I had that white light experience. And don't hear the political thing in this. This is just how it was for me. As a young man, I paid for an abortion, and I used to drink over that, about the what ifs that could come behind that. And if you've done this and it's okay with you, it's okay with me. I'm not here to indict you. I'm talking about this because there are probably people in a room this size who have the same thing that they need to get free on. And I'm just sharing my experience with it. And I received God's forgiveness in that moment. But when I got to step 8, it looked to me like I owed amends to an unborn child, and I didn't know it could be done. I've been in the hands of big book people since my very early recovery. This is page 83. "There may be some wrongs we can never fully right. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we'd right them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. I was shown how to write that letter. For those of you who picked up the handout that I have on crying, I wrote it on the back of that. For anyone who didn't get one, Patrick said that he would run copies and have them available. I'm sure you all know how to get a hold of him. But it's my experience that letter, as we discovered earlier today, the fourth step, although it contains writing, really isn't about writing. It's really about observations and prayers. My experience with this letter is it, too, is not about writing. It is about tears. And it's my experience that people who can't cry don't get free. That's why I put it on the back of the crying thing. That's just my experience with it. And I got free. Nothing happens here when I tell you about this because I got free. And if you've got an unborn child, a grandparent, somebody that's gone, I want you to know that I am completely convinced that you will get free. I serve a powerful God. Gave me a powerful program, far more powerful than all the poison in my past. Whether I was the one that initiated it or I was the one that received it, it doesn't matter. my God and this program are far more powerful than that. I got absolutely free. When I get a new guy to step nine, I got a couple of things that I do. He looks at his list, and we go over the list, and we talk about what the amends are going to be. He's looking at 162 amends, and inside him he's saying, I can't make 162 amends. Something in him is saying, I can't do that. And I agree with that, he can't. But he can make one today. And I apply one day at a time to this concept. And I want to know from him which, and sometimes I put one on hold. I think the ex-wife, I think it's a little bit too fresh. Let's hold on that. So, and I trust what I get for guidance on that. So which one do you want to do next? Okay, that's a pretty good idea. When can you call him and schedule an appointment to make the amend? Why can't you call him right now? Okay, good. Call me right back. Oh, the appointment's tomorrow at 2:30? Good. Call me at 2:45. Phone rings tomorrow, 2:45. Yeah, how'd the amend go? Oh, he didn't even remember who you were? Yeah, well, okay, that happened some. Don't be hurt by that. Who's right? Who's next on your list? Oh, yeah, good choice. I like that one. When can you call him and schedule an appointment? Why can't you call him now? Good. Call me back in 5 minutes. Right? We're only 161 days away from finishing this process. One day at a time applied to that. I want to continuously stay in that process with him. And the other thing I like to do at step nine is that's where I start him sponsoring. He doesn't think he's ready. Well, he's never going to think he's ready. I hope he doesn't. I hope I don't ever think I'm ready to sponsor someone. I'm ready to be God's tool in this life. But boy, when I start thinking I'm ready, am I ever not ready. Run. And what I tell him is, I want you to get a new guy to sponsor. And if you don't get one, I'll get one for you. Stand in the door, you know, and start. Just capture them as they come through. You're new at your first meeting? Well, I'm your sponsor. Come here, we need to talk. Just tell them and just go run with it. And the first thing I want you to get from this new guy is blanket permission to talk to me about his life. I want blanket permission. And what's going to happen here is I'm going to coach you through coaching him through these 12 steps. And we're going to do that as many times as we have to until you really feel like you're conversant with the work. Usually it's just one or two, and then they're off and running. Although most of the phone calls I get from the men I sponsor are about sponsorship, and most of them are sober over 15 years. That's what we talk about the most. But there isn't a lot of that anymore. And so that's the process. And so a couple of things happen. One is he's given it away, which will light him up spiritually. The second one is that it keeps him motivated, keeps him moving in this ninth step. By the time he gets to step nine, what's happened here? He's been promoted at work. He's got money in the bank. His key fits in the front door. When he walks in and throws the switch, the lights come on. The phone rings. That's a miracle by itself. He answers it and admits that it's him. That's another miracle. He's sleeping in the big bed again. All right? So his motivation has kind of waned. And it's my responsibility to not let him settle for relief. I got to get him to recovery. I asked Don not too long before he died what changes he'd seen in his 34 years in AA. And he said, when I got sober, the focus was on recovery. Today it's on sobriety. And the difference is sobriety is simply not drinking today. Doesn't necessarily include recovery. Recovery is this whole spiritual thing that we do that cleans us out and changes us. And that always includes sobriety. So it's my responsibility to not allow him to settle for relief, but to get him to recovery. And part of how I do that is he sees this newcomer catching up with him. And it keeps him moving through step nine, because he doesn't want this guy to get to step 10 before he does, because he's going to have to admit it. So it's a wonderful tool for me to keep him moving. I like in amends, I don't like to use the word sorry. I think there are some exceptions to that. But generally, I like for him to say, I was wrong. I believe I hurt you. Either or both of those are good choices. I also think, generally speaking, if you take your fifth breath while you're making amends, you've already said too much. They don't need all the detail. You go to your mother. She doesn't need to hear your fifth step. I wasn't as good a son to you as I could have been. I know I broke your heart a couple of times. I'm living a different life today, and I'd like to make that right. Can you tell me what I can do to mend that? That's enough. And then let's hear what she's got to say. That's enough. Never, ever mess up an amend with an excuse. As soon as you give an excuse, you've taken all the power away. And that's just kind of what I do. There's another one that's pretty tricky, and I handle this as delicately as I can. Number one, a guy going to a lady to make amends, be dead gum careful how you approach. Maybe through her work or a lady friend or something. Let's don't raise her husband's eyebrow. All right, that would be way out of bounds. And let's say, and this is the best I can do, that you've availed yourself of her charms lately. How do you make amends there without making her feel cheap? And the answer is you say to her, I wasn't as good a friend to you as I could have been. I believe I've done some damage and I'd like to make it right. That's enough. As a matter of fact, that's generally some really solid stuff to use on amends. We don't need to go into all of the descriptions of all of the mistakes and all that stuff that goes with it. This one is a gift from my wife, and I bragged on her a lot, and I don't apologize for that. She was going through the steps another time, got to 9, knows has been very thorough, and yet something was nagging at her heart, and so she prayed about it, and she was given a gift. And the gift is what Miss Linda calls good amends. We have two kinds of sins. We have sins of commission, things we did that harm people, but we also omitted things that left people harmed. And she said it occurred to her that she owed profound thanks to some people in her life, to a teacher who found her on the back row and got her off the back row and got her active in school affairs, to a woman that helped her one night when she was on a run. And I went back and I went to my major professor in college and I thanked him. He did an awfully lot of good things for me. I found the man that taught me to fly. I got to the Air Force with about 30 hours of flying time. And I was at the top of my class the whole time. And it was because of the job that man did with me in that short period of time. And I went and found him. And I said, thank you. I don't think I ever told you how important you were in my life. I'd like to tell you that I really, really appreciate what you did for me. What a wonderful experience what Miss Linda calls good amends is. I don't know if you've thought of that, but that's a powerful thing. And while I'm on the subject, I have promised Patrick's fiancée, Margaret, a set of CDs. Miss Linda and I just did a couple's weekend a couple of weeks ago, and I think it's 6 or 8 CDs that we do occasionally. And there's a handout that goes with that. I'm going to get her a set of it, and y'all can run some. If you're interested in what we give on the handout on that, it's here. What have we met? Oh, a one-liner I think is really powerful. This is a gift from my home group. We believe you take your problems to your sponsor. You take your solutions to your meeting. There's a big difference between an AA meeting and group therapy. Yeah. You got anything? Should we break it?
Yeah.
We're going to take a 1 hour and 29 minute supper break.